At the time that protesters were staging sit-ins and marching against segregation in the 1950s and 1960s, America was also beginning to turn its attention to the stars. And in their new book, We Could Not Fail, Richard Paul and Stephen Moss link the two. They tell the stories of how the first African Americans in the American space program helped affect desegregation in the South and in the larger society. Richard Paul is an independent public radio documentary producer, Stephen Moss, an associate professor of English at Texas State Technical College. And they both join us now. Welcome, both of you. Good to have you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Before we get to the link between the space program pioneers, if you will, and the drive for equal rights in this country, first of all, we know very few of the stories of these folks who really blazed a trail in NASA, because most of them weren't astronauts. They weren't in the public eye. Tell us a little bit about who they were and what they did.
Sure. I mean, we can give you a short version of some of the highlights of the people in the book. Julius Montgomery was a guy who soldered missile parts and went and found missiles when they crash landed. He faced down the Ku Klux Klan at Cape Canaveral. He also integrated the Florida Institute of Technology. There's Frank Crosley, who was the first African-American PhD in metallurgical engineering. He patented He had five patents in titanium alloys that were the skins of rockets and missiles. George Carruthers, the first telescope ever set on another planetary body, was designed and invented by George Carruthers. Morgan Watson was NASA's first black engineer, and he helped design the heat shields for the Saturn V rocket. And Clyde Foster, who is my favorite one, got more black workers' jobs, advanced the education of more black engineering students, and cleared the path towards equality more enduringly and forcefully than any other African-American NASA employee. So those are some of the people in the book.
Now, did these men start by knocking on NASA's door and just had to keep knocking and knocking until they were let in? Or did NASA say, hey, look, we have a problem with diversity here, and they went looking for them and recruited them?
NASA went looking for them. NASA realized that to be compliant with President Kennedy's Executive Order 10925, that called for the end of racial discrimination in federal hiring, NASA had to, all of the agencies, but NASA in particular in the South, had to go out and find African Americans to work in NASA for jobs other than custodial and secretarial. And eventually they did find these, but recruiting was a serious, serious problem for NASA and for NASA contractors. And Richard can tell us a lot about the recruiting program.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's an important thing to know that NASA, after President Kennedy made his announcement that we're going to put a man on the moon before the end of the decade, NASA, over the next few years, created 250,000 new jobs in Florida, Alabama, Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi.
So that's where the aerospace industry was. Yeah.
Well, yeah, that's right. You've got the old South, and you've got these brand new facilities that are hiring thousands and thousands of people. And the president signs this executive order, and now they have got to hire. They've got to find and hire African Americans.
Gentlemen, you talked about Kennedy, but also Johnson as well, after Kennedy's assassination, had to use NASA as a tool for federal desegregation. And I imagine that there might have been some in Congress that weren't too fond of that.
Well, there were always the old Southern Democrats who weren't fond of anything related
sure.
to civil rights or desegregation. But Johnson in 1964... electorally, with his majority and his mandate to build this great society and the space program in full swing, and the Civil Rights Act had been enacted and was slowly going into force. So with the full Johnson presidency as of 1964-1965, congressional opposition to this type of thing was greatly diminished, as in contrast to, say, 1961 or 1962.
And we found a terrific telephone call where Senator John Stennis from Mississippi is calling Lyndon Johnson, because the head of NASA was supposed to speak at a segregated meeting. And the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee has called the White House and told them that they're going to be out there with placards in front if this NASA employee, the head of NASA, is allowed to speak. And Stennis is calling the president saying, "Oh, Mr. President, you got to make this stop." And he says, "I'm sorry, my friend. You know, we're not allowed to speak at segregated meetings." It's this wonderful telephone call. And you hear Stennis sort of back off and say, I'm sorry, Mr. President." And you really can sort of get the sense of Johnson using the force of his personality to make the changes that he really felt were important. But as Stephen says, it was a really different situation during the Kennedy administration.
So, fellas, now we have the policy, we have the federal government intervening. Let's talk about when these men actually showed up for work, when they actually became a part of the different departments. I'm curious to know how they were received.
Well, Julius Montgomery tells this really amazing story of his first day. Again, remember, the Ku Klux Klan controlled that part of Florida. He walks in on the first day and he said nobody would shake his hand. He goes up to each one of these guys and they turn their backs and nobody would shake his hand. And he says, "I got to the last man and I said, 'Hello, my name is Julius Montgomery.' And he says, 'Boy, that's no way to talk to a white man.' And Julius says, and I looked at him and I said, 'Oh, excuse me, oh great white bastard, what should I call you?'" And he says, and he laughed and I laughed and he shook my hand. It's an amazing story. And Julius was an amazing character. And he used humor in a lot of situations to get by.
And also with some of the others who worked in Huntsville, they tell the story of how when they were in the office, on the facility, on the Huntsville facility or the Redstone Arsenal, it was a desegregated policy. It was federal land. But when they stepped off base, when they stepped out of the workplace,
it was different.
They were in Huntsville, they were in the South, and everything got flipped again. So they were back in the segregated community. They were back in Wallace's Alabama just by walking out the door.
That's right.
And they relate stories of going to diners, of social events like going to a Ray Charles concert, which was roped off black and white audiences. And
they tell a story of the first six African American engineers at NASA who were in Alabama. Morgan Watson, they all related this story of coming back from a concert one night, and they stop in at the only place that was open for food. And the six of them walk in. You know, these are guys that work at NASA. You know, they've really got this whole, they're imbued with the whole space age thing when they're at work. And they walk into this diner and the waitress says, "Hey, colored side's closed." And one of them says, "Look, we want to get a hamburger." And she says, "Colored side's closed. Get out of here." And they persisted and they persisted. And the waitress said, "I'm calling the police." Now, this was just a handful of days after those bodies showed up in Philadelphia, Mississippi. These people were killed by the police and buried in the woods someplace, or buried by a lake, I don't recall. And these guys knew what this was. And when she said, "I'm calling the police," Morgan said, "We got back in the car and we hightailed it back over to Huntsville." The way he put it was, "When you leave Huntsville, you're in Alabama."
Gentlemen, I'm also curious, at any point did any of the men, did they ever talk about reaching a point where they thought, maybe I should just leave, that this overt racism is just too much?
You know, I asked Morgan about that when I interviewed him, and it's an interesting thing that we found. There is this myth that NASA was changed by this army of Yankee rocket scientists that came down and changed the culture of the South. It turns out that NASA's workforce, both black and white, was principally from the South. And Morgan Watson told me, and several others of the people when I interviewed them, that we knew the rules. That's the way he put it. And he and Clyde Foster, who was also in Alabama, told stories about people who came from the North, who came from Detroit, from the auto industry, or came from California, from the airplane industry, and came to Alabama and just couldn't handle it, because the way they both put it was they didn't know the rules. Mm-hmm. But it was something about the fact that the workforce in the South was a Southern workforce. Everybody knew the rules. And so, no, from the people in our book, no one said that he got disgusted and wanted to leave.
But there was Frank Crosley, who, independent of NASA, needed a plan B because he decided he was going to be an engineer, but he realized his career options in the United States were limited, and so he looked at plan B. He could go to Canada, where they spoke English, or he could go to Mexico, where there were people of color. And I think that's indicative of the state of race relations and race hiring at that time.
Richard Paul and Stephen Moss are with us. Their book is We Could Not Fail, the stories of the first African Americans in the American Space Program. Wanted to see how that link came from these first NASA workers to the people who followed them in the next generation, if you will. Ron McNair is probably the astronaut in terms of early astronauts of color that most Americans think of because he was among the crew in the Challenger disaster, and he has family ties here in Atlanta. So how or did folks like Ron McNair look to these earlier NASA workers and say, look, you provided the bridge from the folks who working and the technical work that they did behind the scenes to finally saying, here, NASA, we have a diverse astronaut crew?
Well, Mae Jemison, who was the first African-American woman in space and was the narrator of the documentary that I produced on this subject, told me that her father was a roofer who worked on the facility in Huntsville. And so she always felt a connection to outer space because of that. But I'll tell you a story. We had a wonderful event in 2010 where Julius Montgomery, who was the first African-American hired at Cape Canaveral as anything other than a janitor, and Morgan Watson, who was NASA's first African-American engineer, were on a panel with Mae Jemison and Leland Melvin, who had just gotten back from the International Space Station. And after it was over, everybody was shaking hands in the back. Julius had told that story about how on the first day nobody would shake his hand. And he goes up to Leland Melvin at the end and he says, I got to tell you, you astronauts are just the bravest people I've ever met. And Leland Melvin looks at him and he says, no, sir, I heard your story. You are the bravest person that I've ever met. And the two of them shook hands. It was really, really moving and just showed just a connection between these generations. They really, really do recognize this.
Yeah, and mentioning Mae Jemison is really important because these early pioneers at NASA were, at least if I follow the book correctly, were all men. At what point do we start to see African-American women make inroads?
You know, NASA really, really said
because that was
that
a pretty macho culture.
Yeah, well, NASA really said that they tried, and I've read all of the employment reports that they put out and that sort of thing. But the thinking really was, okay, if there are going to be women here, they're going to be secretaries. And we saw report after report where, oh, we gave them the civil service secretary test and nobody could pass it. So no, we can't hire any African American, any Negro women, as they would have said back then. So it took a very long time, and It took a long time for women to get in the door at NASA anyhow, and it was even harder for African-American women.
And I would say also, just on sheer employment, throughout the 1960s, NASA's African-American employment averaged around 3% of the overall NASA workforce. So it was very slow in increasing numbers, absolute numbers, and percentage of the overall workforce. And in some facilities, like the Mississippi facility, there were zero NASA employees who were African Americans in 1965, but there were 750 African Americans working for NASA contractors at that site. And in Brevard County at Cape Kennedy, the numbers were really very bad, that there were maybe 11 African-Americans working out of a workforce of 1,500, and this, I think, is about 1964. So the numbers are very small, but the numbers improved as time went on. And that, I think, is really important.
And did any of NASA's minority recruitment programs and some of the orders that came from the administrations on recruitment, did those eventually translate into policy for the wider society?
policy for the wider society? You mean, did people follow NASA's lead?
Yeah.
No, not at all. No, not at all. No, NASA was consistently bad through the 1960s in terms of finding African Americans to hire. And a lot of that has to do with NASA corporate culture. The agency saw itself as an outstanding agency beyond, the other federal bureaucrats as they saw it. We hire the best people. We hire the engineers and we bring people in from industry. And you combine that that way of thinking about yourself with a society, with a workplace that's mostly Southern and a sense of Black inferiority, it would have been nearly impossible to find an African American who your standard, personnel person at NASA would have said, oh, yeah, he's the best. He's the best one we can find. And we hear stories from all of the people in the book about the discrimination that was faced either by themselves or by other people just because of the NASA corporate culture.
The book is We Could Not Fail by Richard Paul and Stephen Moss. Richard Paul, an independent public radio documentary producer. Stephen Moss, an associate professor of English at Texas State Technical College. Thanks to both of you for being with us. Some great stories in there. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen.